Today is Friday, June 5th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover the structural power shift confirmed at the Putin-Xi summit and what Beijing's deliberate withholding of a single pipeline deal tells us about who really controls the Sino-Russian axis. After 20 years of negotiation, after 25 visits by Vladimir Putin to Beijing, after approximately 40 agreements signed at this month's summit, the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline still has no deal. That single fact, more than anything else produced by the June 2026 Putin-Xi summit, tells you everything about the current balance of power between Moscow and Beijing. Dr. Evan Medeiros, former senior director for Asian Affairs at the NSC and now at Georgetown, and Dr. Andrea Kendall-Taylor, former deputy national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia and now at CNA's, analyze this summit in detail for CS's China Power Program. Sasanes. Their convergent assessment is stark. Beijing has successfully converted Russia from a peer partner into a manageable dependent asset. Xi Jinping signed 40 largely ceremonial agreements, people-to-people exchanges, educational cooperation, Arctic infrastructure, visa-free travel, while withholding the one deliverable Moscow most desperately needed. The strategic calculus here is that China knows Russia needs the pipeline, and Beijing withholds it at minimal cost to itself, while denying Moscow a major political win.
That is not partnership. That is leverage management. The protocol signals reinforce the substance. This summit was formatted as a single-day, non-state visit, a deliberate contrast to the two-day state visit, according to President Trump just days earlier.
Medeiros' comparative analysis of joint statements from 2022 through 2026 shows the 2026 document, while physically longer than the 2025 version, was notably more circumscribed. Gone was the targeted anti-U.S. language on AUKUS, on INF and ABM treaty violations, on biolabs allegations. The joint military cooperation language was, in Medeiros' own word, generic. Russia's position in Beijing's strategic ledger is shrinking in explicit terms even as the relationship continues in form. The shifting geography of power here maps cleanly onto trade composition. Russia exports exclusively natural resources to China. China exports back machinery, industrial goods, internal combustion engine vehicles, vehicles that China's own domestic market has moved past, with Russia functioning as a disposal market, plus consumer electronics, automated manufacturing equipment, and robotics. Moscow now depends on essentially one supplier for automated manufacturing and robotics. That is a structural dependency with extraordinarily high switching costs. Building on that, Medeiros notes that Chinese private and quasi-private investment flows into Russia are, in his words, so limited as to constitute a signal. Chinese private capital is betting against Russia's long-term commercial viability.
Medeiros draws the historically resonant parallel directly. The current dynamic inverts the 1950s Soviet-Chinese relationship, in which Moscow was the senior partner transferring industrial and military technology to a developing China. The 1960 Sino-Soviet split, triggered partly by Soviet refusal to share nuclear technology and Chinese resentment of structural dependency, is the most analytically relevant historical precedent. Putin's calculation that he can tolerate asymmetric dependency temporarily and rebalance after Ukraine mirrors how revisionist powers historically accept subordination as a transactional cost. But as Medeiros observes, the Russian elite anxiety visible in military blogger commentary and the absence of Power of Siberia 2 from summit deliverables suggests the dependency is becoming visible in ways the Kremlin is struggling to narrate away. Kendall-Taylor raises an additional risk. Under the current U.S. administration, the transparency that previously allowed external monitoring of China-Russia military technical cooperation has diminished significantly. That opacity increases the risk around potential sophisticated technology transfers, particularly in domains where Russia retains residual advantage, including undersea and submarine warfare. While Beijing tightens its structural grip, Moscow is managing what can only be described as a compounding triple crisis, and the arithmetic is unforgiving. Start with manpower. According to Dr. Jason Smart, citing the Institute for the Study of War, 70,500 Russian military contracts were signed in the first quarter of 2026 against an estimated operational requirement of 100,000, a deficit of approximately 30%. Monthly contract averages of roughly 23,500 compare unfavorably to Western casualty estimates of approximately 30,000 per month. Russia is not replacing its losses. It is falling further behind on a net basis every single month. Layer onto that the fiscal dimension. A finance ministry letter obtained by the Financial Times reveals that Russia's defense spending is on track to exceed its 2025 budgeted ceiling by at least $28 billion. The budget deficit for 2026 had already surpassed its full-year projection within the first 4 months of 2025. Russia's finance minister has instructed non-military ministries, social welfare, manufacturing support, infrastructure, healthcare, education, to cut expenditures and redirect funds toward military and security sectors. The coercive logic of Putin's regime, the protection compact in which loyalty is purchased through licensed extraction, is under acute strain as the extractable rents contract. Then add the energy infrastructure dimension. Analyst Scott Lucas reports that 24 of Russia's 33 leading refineries have been struck by Ukrainian drones, many repeatedly, disrupting an estimated 25-30% of domestic gasoline and diesel production. Russia has implemented a gasoline export ban and moved to domestic fuel rationing in Crimea and parts of core Russian territory. Smart reports of voucher rationing system for gasoline in St. Petersburg itself. Russian oil output is at a 16-year low, and perhaps most symbolically, during Russia's flagship annual economic showcase, the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, Ukrainian drones struck oil facilities near the city, leaving visible smoke plumes in the backdrop of Putin's prestige event. The strategic calculus here is that these three crises are not parallel stresses. They form a compounding feedback loop. Negative manpower replacement plus fiscal cannibalization of civilian welfare plus cascading fuel shortages generates mounting domestic political pressure on a trajectory that is cumulatively corrosive, even if not immediately destabilizing. Smart draws two pointed historical parallels. The first is Ceausescu's Romania in 1989, where the weaponization of security services against all categories of elite, including previously loyal cadres, produced rapid coalition collapse when external pressure provided a coordination moment. The second is Mobutu's Zaire in the late 1980s through 1996, where a patronage system that shifted from licensed extraction to active predation amid declining resource flows produced cascading elite defection and eventual regime collapse. The structural dynamic most closely paralleling the current Russian moment, however, is the late Soviet period of 1985 through 1991, declining revenues eroding the nomenklatura's capacity to maintain loyalty through material distribution, the critical divergence. Gorbachev attempted liberalization as a response. Putin's apparatus is attempting extraction intensification, which historically accelerates rather than arrests elite defection dynamics. This is visible on the ground. At the St. Petersburg Forum, Alexander Vino, son of Putin's chief of staff, publicly stated that Russian entrepreneurs actively avoid state subsidies because accepting government assistance triggers prosecutorial scrutiny. Direct state support for small and medium enterprises fell from approximately $130 million to $75 million in a single quarter, a 42% contraction. The market failure is now self-documenting at Russia's own premier economic venue. The third major stress on the strategic map runs through the Strait of Hormuz, and it connects the Iran theater directly to every other dynamic we've covered. Scott Lucas reports that the United States and Iran came very close to a framework deal approximately 1 to 2 weeks prior to his interview. Iranian terms included arrangements governing the Strait of Hormuz, lifting of the American blockade on Iranian ports, gradual sanctions relief, the unfreezing of approximately $12 billion in Iranian assets, a 60-day ceasefire, and subsequent nuclear negotiations. The Trump administration retreated from this framework under domestic pressure, with Secretary Rubio and Treasury Secretary Bessent among those backing away. Trump subsequently demanded Iran discuss its nuclear program first, decline asset unfreezing, and open the Strait of Hormuz, terms Tehran has rejected. The strategic calculus here is what Lucas terms the Gulliver's Travels dynamic. American and Israeli military action eliminated Iranian leadership without neutralizing Tehran's primary leverage instrument, the Strait itself. Iran's negotiating posture is resilient, precisely because the administration faces a binary between a ground invasion that is domestically lethal and a negotiated framework functionally equivalent to the 2015 JCPOA, the agreement Trump withdrew from in 2018. That constraint produces escalatory stalemate that neither resolves the underlying leverage question nor relieves market disruption. Investment analyst Stephen Feldman on the Wealthion platform identifies a structural irony with direct long-term policy implications. An administration ideologically opposed to renewable energy has, through the military action precipitating the Hormuz closure, provided the single most powerful structural catalyst for renewable energy adoption in the current era. Solar and wind assets are being reframed not as climate instruments, but as sovereignty instruments, inputs that cannot be embargoed, interdicted, or priced by a foreign cartel. That reframing, Feldman argues, will accelerate bipartisan convergence on domestic clean energy investment regardless of stated policy preferences, as the relevant comparison shifts from environmental risk versus fossil fuels to grid resilience versus blackout risk. Feldman also identifies multiple oil-dependent nations liquidating U.S. Treasury holdings to subsidize domestic fuel prices, a second-order fiscal spillover connecting energy geopolitics directly to sovereign debt dynamics. With gold at approximately $4,500 per ounce at time of recording and U.S. federal debt at approximately $39 trillion, the headwinds on U.S. long-end yields from this foreign official liquidation operate independently of Federal Reserve policy. If sustained, it represents a qualitative shift in dollar reserve currency mechanics. Feldman invokes the 1973 Arab oil embargo as the most direct historical precedent, while noting the key structural divergence. The 1973 shock occurred within a functioning multilateral order with institutional capacity to restore flows. The post-Hormuz environment lacks comparable institutional trust architecture, suggesting faster and potentially more durable structural change. Against this backdrop of Russian attrition and diplomatic stalemate, Ukraine is demonstrating something analysts did not fully anticipate entering 2026, asymmetric momentum. CSIS analysts Max Bergman and Maria Snegovaya, reporting from firsthand stakeholder meetings in Kyiv in May 2025, assess that Ukraine has regained the advantage in drone warfare after Russia held the edge in fall 2024. Ukrainian first-person view drones have made Russian massed offensives prohibitively costly on the front lines, while longer-range systems functioning as de facto cruise missiles are targeting Russian logistics and strategic infrastructure at previously inconceivable distances. Russian nuclear submarine facilities, located approximately 7,400 kilometers from Ukraine, are now covered with anti-drone netting, a signal that the psychological perimeter of vulnerability has expanded dramatically. Bergman characterizes Russia's defense sector as a T-Rex, producing at enormous scale but slow to adapt. Ukraine's innovation cycle, by contrast, operates like a velociraptor. That asymmetry in adaptation speed is producing measurable results. Smart reports that Russian territorial gains in early 2026 fell more than 90% compared to the same period in 2025, a figure requiring independent verification against ISW and ACLED conflict mapping, but directionally consistent with the manpower arithmetic we covered earlier. Most analytically significant structural shift, however, is Ukraine's transition from aid recipient to security contributor. Snegovaya notes growing Gulf state interest in Ukrainian defense partnerships, driven by the reputational signal of Russian air defense failures against U.S. and Israeli strikes in Iran. Gulf states evaluating defense modernization are reportedly looking to Ukraine as a source of drone technology and expertise. Kyiv's reduced dependence on direct U.S. assistance, with the EU providing approximately 90 billion euros per Bergman citation, and its growing role as a defense technology exporter, represent a fundamental change in the Western security architecture. But a critical vulnerability runs across both theaters. The drawdown of Patriot interceptor stocks during U.S. and Israeli operations against Iran has directly constrained Ukrainian air defense capacity. Russia is exploiting this gap by increasing deployment of advanced ballistic missiles that Ukraine currently has limited capacity to intercept. Since the CSIS delegation departed Kyiv, Russia has launched several of the largest combined drone and missile barrages on record against Ukrainian cities. The Iran theater's consumption of assets directly affects Ukrainian defensive capacity. That is the multi-theater coordination challenge facing Western planners, and it is not being managed cleanly. On the diplomatic track, Lucas reports the Kremlin has conducted what he characterizes as psychological profiles on Trump administration officials, identifying envoy Steve Witkoff as the primary vulnerability due to his receptivity to U.S.-Russia economic partnership narratives. Witkoff has conducted multiple visits to Moscow, on at least one occasion without senior American diplomats present, while neither he nor Jared Kushner has visited Ukraine during the full-scale invasion. Zelensky has indicated he expects both officials to visit Kyiv within approximately 2 weeks of Lucas's interview. Whether that visit materializes and what post-visit statements contain will be among the most diagnostic signals in the near-term diplomatic landscape. The signal to monitor most closely in the next 48 hours is the G7 summit at Evian. Zelensky arrives with three specific asks: additional Patriot interceptors, intensified Shadow Fleet sanctions enforcement, and capital for domestic drone intercept production scale-up. Specific deliverables on interceptor supply commitments and Shadow Fleet enforcement language will either confirm or challenge the assessment that the Western commitment architecture is holding under fiscal and political pressure. Any ambiguity in the communique on those three points should be read not as diplomatic boilerplate, but as a structural signal about the durability of European political will, and Moscow will read it exactly that way. Thank you for your time today. That's your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. The convergence of Chinese structural primacy, Russian triple crisis arithmetic, and Hormuz stalemate is reshaping the architecture of great power competition in ways that will not resolve quickly. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.